Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly's. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I will be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect know-how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
How'd it go?
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Yo, B.I., man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday, you know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised with you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights, close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
Alright. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
but you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
I don't know. But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. He a man.
Did you prime it? That little rubber ball right there next to the spark plug. Gotta push it in 3 times before you try to start it. Gets the gas going to the car.
You want the truth? I ain't never used one of these. Never had no call to.
Yeah, well, I didn't pick you up for your landscaping skills. All these Spanish, they on paper too. Only use people like y'all. Sometimes it comes back on me, sometimes it works out fine.
Well, how long you been uptown?
10 years.
Hotter than a motherfucker out here.
Yeah, it's hot. Every day. You're going to be riding in the back of that hard truck, bouncing around every day. And your back's going to be yelling at you every day. I used to drive an SL, pretty gold convertible, nice rims. I don't even think on that car no more.
You put it behind you, huh?
Some can't. I'm just saying, you want to stay on the straight. Ain't going to be no big reward to it. This is it, right here. Prime that bitch 3 times. She'll start right up.
How'd it go?
We got one out of 2 of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
You'll be out. Man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man. You know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right. Relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised with you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know?
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights, close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you, to let you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
I don't know. But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. He a man.
live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working, and then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tonnes of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better, and so I get more customers.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions. And that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills. And then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
All right, today's podcast is titled, we're still on 6 hours, but want to do a quick feature, The Barber of Natchez. The Barber of Natchez, Natchez is spelled N-A-T-C-H-E-Z. The Barber of Natchez, I posted some information on The Barber of Natchez on our Facebook page, which is It's My House TV. Just go to It's My House TV, and then you'll see that. I'll do some reading about the Barber of Natchez here momentarily. But I got an email or a text. Which one is it? I guess it's a text. That gave a statistic, which I think is kind of high now. Maybe I'm reading it out of context. It says about 10% to 20%. Oh, okay. I was reading it wrong. I read it out of context. Right. About, here's an interesting statistic. Thank you, Pianchi, for sending it to me. 10 to 20% of black American millionaires are Africans. Let's see. Wouldn't a better title be, a more accurate title be, about 10 to 20% of black people in the United States are Africans? All right, well, either way. So if you see a black person walking down the street, and you think they're a millionaire, then more than likely they're African. Not African American. Which, you know what, there's a comedian, he's passed over now, Ralphie May. He made an interesting statement. If you've never been to Africa, how can you be African American? Now, if you've got somebody that was born and raised on the continent, South Africa, Uganda, Zimbabwe, Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, the Gambia, pick your country. Born and raised in one of those countries, and then you move to America and you got citizenship, that person would be African American. You know, Elon Musk, I don't know if he's got American citizenship yet, but if he did, he would be, as a white man, he would be African American because he was born and raised in South Africa. So he's African, white skin, but African. Who's more black? Wrong word. Who's more African, Elon Musk or Jesse Jackson? Jesse Jackson wasn't born in Africa. He was born here in the United States. He claims to be African American, but he wasn't born there. Elon Musk, on the other hand, was born, he's African. White skin, but African. So who's more African? I say Elon Musk. But if you disagree, 619-768-2945, and then we want to go over this. 10 to 20% of the people that are culturally considered black in the United States, 10% to 20% of those people are African. Excuse me, wrong. Millionaires. All right. I want to go over the video real quick. And so let me do that. Then I'll go straight to the phone lines. And then we're going to talk about the Barber of Natchez. The Barber of Natchez. Natchez spelled N-A-T-C-H-E-Z. Natchez, like in Natchez, Mississippi. We're going to talk about the Barber of Natchez. And matter of fact, originally I wasn't even going to, I didn't even, 2 hours ago, I didn't know who the Barber of Natchez was. I'll discuss how I found out about him and put him on the program for this morning. All right, we'll be back in a few minutes. Then we'll go to the phone lines.
Today we have organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves
in a continuing way that there is opportunity there. That given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think, really, that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security, if they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today, and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business. Somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all wanted to refer me to the contributions department. And I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside. I was delayed, but I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information. There are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
Okay, that was a little bit about the late John H. Johnson. I do highly recommend his autobiography, Succeeding Against the Odds. Classic, classic book, when that book was first released, I bought 8 copies and gave 7 of those copies away to friends and colleagues. All right, today, 6 hours, and before we go to the phone lines and talk about Africans who are millionaires in America, we're going to do a little quick feature here on the Barber of Natchez, and I have posted the link about the Barber of Natchez on our Facebook page, which is It's My House. Our Facebook page is It's My House TV. Okay, who was the Barber of Natchez? His name was William T. Johnson, 1808, Sunrise, June 17th, 1851, Sunset, was a free African-American, and we got to talk about that term. He was a free American. Okay. Barber, born a slave of biracial heritage who lived in Natchez, Mississippi. He was born into slavery, but his owner, also named William Johnson, and was thought to be his father, emancipated him in 1820. His mother, Amy, had been freed in 1814, and his sister, Adelia, emancipated in 1818. Johnson trade, and I got a picture of him in our Scrolling Marquee here on Blog Talk Radio. Johnson trained with his brother-in-law, James Miller, as a barber and began working in Port Gibson, Mississippi. He returned to Natchez, becoming a successful entrepreneur with a barbershop, bathhouse, and bookstore, and land holdings. Through a former slave, William Johnson went to own his own, all right, excuse me, I read that wrong. Though a former slave, William Johnson, also known as the Barber of Natchez, went on to own 16 of his own slaves himself. Through, and here's what inspired me, because like 2 hours ago, I didn't know who this dude was. I was on Clubhouse, and you got to download that, because we have a room on there too. Don't sell mama's house. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. So, well, long story short, there's a lot of history, and what I consider positive history, particularly black history here in the United States, that a lot of us do not know about. And then, you know, we hear the same, two of the go-to stories when it comes to black folk that are victimhood stories. This is my take on it. Wall Street, they talk about that, you know, that riot that happened there, and then Rosewood. When there's hundreds, if not thousands, of other success stories by slaves or former slaves, and it's all documented, but people don't talk about it. So I said, you know what? I put out some information on Mississippi and Africa and Greenville, Liberia, which is based out of Greenville. A lot of success. Put it this way. There's a lot of William Johnsons. There were many of them. There were many a black entrepreneur started out life legally as slaves. Now, one of the things that he did to become wealthy, he learned how to cut hair. There were a lot of William Johnsons. There's others that women that learn, you know, women's hair. A lot of, quite a few black women back, we were talking about slavery times, Jim Crow times, that there were a lot of black women who became proficient and prolific, what do you call them, midwives, delivering babies. I featured one on here before, Bridget Biddy Mason. However, Rosewood and Black Wall Street. That's the two primary go-to stories when, you know, and I hate to say it, black folks are talking about, you know, getting in victim mode. And I'm like 2 hours away from, maybe an hour and a half, or no more than 2 hours away from Rosewood. And John Singleton didn't give an accurate, he took dramatic license of that. Rosewood was not a black township. There were 10 to 15, and I've had a historian on here a few years ago, Lizzie Jenkins. It was not a black township. You had 10 to 15 black households in Rosewood, but when they did torch the town, but, and they did it on a roof, but they torched everybody's house, including white folks' house. And you had blacks and whites that had to run into the woods, forests, swamps to save their lives. However, 45 minutes away from me, hardly anybody talks about Eatonville, Florida. Over 100 years old, easily the oldest black township in the state of Florida, and arguably the oldest black township in the United States. Depends on who you talk to. But it's up there. And it's 6 miles outside of Orlando. And it's you know, a nice little town. It's not rural. Used to be rural, but it's its own municipality. Like I say, only 6 miles away from Orlando. You know, so it's in a very unique place, but hardly anybody talks about it. Anyway. So I said, well, I knew some things that happened positive in Mississippi. I said, well, let me look up more, and I came across William Johnson, the barber of Natchez. Anyway, so though a former slave, William Johnson went on to own 16 slaves himself. He began a diary in 1835, which he continued through the remainder of his life. Also in 1835, he married Ann Battle, a free woman of color with a similar background to his, and they had 11 children. Johnson loaned money to many people. You know, he was a lender too, okay, a de facto banker, including the governor of Mississippi, who had signed his emancipation papers. Now, man, isn't that something? He is a guy that was born a former slave. I mean, he was born a slave, learned to trade, cutting hair from his brother-in-law, became a slave owner himself, 16 slaves. He had at least 800 acres of land. And the governor of Mississippi at that time, who signed his emancipation papers, the governor's day job obviously wasn't paying him enough. So here's this white governor having to go to a former slave for a loan. This country is about capitalism. That's the great equalizer. Capitalism, if you want to, that's one of the reasons why I have no interest, me personally, in reparations. Because through capitalism, anybody can make it. This guy, if you know what, let's take Martin Luther King's statue off the Washington Mall and put in this guy's statue. The governor of Mississippi had to borrow money. All his white friends couldn't help him out. And he's a governor now. You know, to be the governor, you got to be well connected to get that high. Anyway, let's see. Okay. Now, there is a down part to this story. Johnson was murdered in 1851 after adjudicated boundary dispute by a mixed-race neighbor named Baylor Wynn. In other words, black-on-black crime. In front of his son, a free black apprentice, and a slave. Wynn was held in prison for 2 years and brought to trial twice. Johnson was such a well-respected businessman that the outrage over his murder caused the trial to be held in a neighboring town. In that town, no one knew Wynn, so they didn't know that he was half black. Since Mississippi law forbade blacks from testifying against whites in criminal cases, Wynn's defense was that he was half white and half Native American, making him white by law. The defense worked, and none of the black witnesses could testify, and Wynn escaped conviction. Johnson's diary was rediscovered in 1938 and published in 1951. You can buy this on Amazon, people, right now. It's available for sale on Amazon. All right, it reveals much of the daily life of a 19th century Mississippi businessman, including the fact that he himself was a slaveholder. His papers are archived at LSU, Louisiana State University. Through an act of Congress, the home of William Johnson became a part of the Natchez National Historical Park in 1990. All right, so I want to do more research on him, which I will, but I encourage you to do the same as well. So here's a guy that, man, amazing. Simply amazing. No internet connection. No smartphone. No Jesse Jackson, NAACP, no Al Sharpton, no MLK. But he got wealthy through capitalism. You know, if I had to do a Mount Rushmore of, and there's so many ways you can do a Mount Rushmore, but Mount Rushmore's of African American, well, I got to stop using that term because he was not African. He was American. Black folk, I'd have to put this guy in there. What did it for me is he ended up, once again, he loaned the governor, state of Mississippi, money. He's my number one draft pick for black folks, Mount Rushmore. I don't know who the other three people are. I got to think about it. And that's why I study this type of history so much, because there's so many gems that you can pick up. Now, before I go to the phone lines, let's see. Pianchi sent me, and I did get a chance when I was playing some of the videos for you guys, 10 to 20% of the, I'm going to say, black folks in this country that are millionaires, 10 to 20% of that figure are, all right, 10%, 20% of the black millionaires in this country are African. That's the way I want to put it. All right. And before I go to the phone lines on that, thank you, Bianchi, for that. And then I want to, let's see, look up. Okay, let me see. Okay. I just had to double check. Elon Musk was born in Pretoria, South Africa. Elon Musk is African. White skin and all. Elon Musk is African. Now, he also has United States citizenship. All right. Therefore, Elon Musk is African American. I've got dark skin, but I wasn't born in Africa. Therefore, I cannot, by definition, be African American. Anyway, I'm just saying. So, let me see. I'm going to look at one more thing. Okay, well, maybe we need to get a panel on that one day. Black versus African American. Or American. Anyway. 619-768. Now, matter of fact, if anybody wants to tackle that one, are they African American? Are they black? Or do you have to be black to be African American? Elon Musk, and there are many others like Elon Musk. There's scores of white folks that are born in Africa every day. They're African. So it looks like being black doesn't automatically make you African American. Elon Musk is African American. Okay, 314, your mic is open.
Hey, LA, how you doing?
Fine. I'm glad you sent me that article. When I first read the title, I misread it, then I read it again and got it in proper context.
Well, we're going to get you out of here early so you can save money. Ain't no need to pay all that money. I mean, the money that you could save in 2 hours. I mean, how often you're 9, 10:30, 11:30. In 1 hour, you could put that toward it, buy some land.
Well, all right, you sent me that article on 20% of, I know in Washington, D.C. that's visible. Because in Washington, D.C., some gas stations I go to, convenience stores in black neighborhoods, or at Union Station. I don't know. Well, since the pandemic, I heard a lot of stuff closed up there. But a lot of vendors at the bus station, the train station, probably the airports around D.C. I know a McDonald's right outside of D.C., just right across the line. It was all Nigerian. So it's visible in D.C.
I said you know.
Entrepreneurs that are wealthy, huh?
I said, since you know the email of a large general contractor in Chicago that's owned by Nigerians called Ujamaa. Use a Swahili name. Is that not something? But no, it just goes to show you the opportunities that exist here in the United States for those who have it. I recognize those who have the gumption to pursue and the skills to succeed.
And I'm on that website right now. Ujamaa Construction, rebuilding our community one block at a time.
Absolutely. They get involved in commercial construction. But see, one of the big drawbacks amongst, and I don't know, like I said before, you may have reached the saturation point where it just ain't just not going to get no better. And these conversations have been had. How long can you reckon of the conversation about what Black Americans
some of the conversations I run across on the, you know, Clubhouse, it's, I've heard that conversation at least 100 or more times 40 years ago, okay?
Absolutely, and even before that, they go back into the 1900s.
Right.
At least, and have been complained about. Had made mention that they don't support the businesses that's supposed to be quote-unquote Black, and naturally so, because it depends on what the interest is. You don't support interest that's going to go against your interest. It just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, one of the big drawbacks, and I really feel sort of sad on this, is the education of Black kids. You have such a preponderous number that's not being educated, and that's nobody's fault but the parents and families themselves, and to a lesser extent, that society. But that society is not going to educate your child to take power from there. You think Nigerians, just these billionaires, teetering on billionaire status, is going to teach Black Americans? They don't look at Black Americans like that. There ain't no kin. You just got some skin color, but they don't make you kin. They don't identify in that particular manner. I mean, that's a fact that you have to reckon with for those who think otherwise.
True.
But if you're not educating your children, you ain't educating them kids. And I was just listening to astrophysicists. Mr. Tyson, he talked about his childhood and the exposures that his parents gave him or presented to him when he was coming up in the science, the museums, the lectures, the trips to see spectacular things. And it was through that exposure that he had a yearning for what he ended up going into. Heck, he had a college offer. I believe it was Cornell. I'm not sure. It might have been Pepperdine. But he ended up going to Harvard. and he's not the only one. There's several Black physicists, astrophysicists. But it just goes to show you. Then when you look at the laureate, Nobel laureate winners, Nobel Prize winner, where the categories are from physics, medicine, chemistry, and so on, you have no Black Americans that's been awarded those prizes. The only prizes Black Americans has been awarded is peace. And you have Toni Morrison in literature. Same thing in Africa, period.
Man, we need to get into the sciences.
So, how many years, how many generations are you technically behind?
I say at least six.
And then you got these black news services that like to go out and co-op these African kids just because they're skin black and write up reports like youngest black female to attend medical school. Well, guess what? She's not no native African American. She's African. You mean you follow
right.
me what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're stealing these people's identity.
Never thought about it that way, but you're right.
Look at that young lady that was last year that won the National Spelling Bee. That lady wasn't no American. That young girl was Ghanaian. That could dribble through a full basketball at the same time. She's very skillful at that. Matter of fact, she's in the Guinness World Book of Records for being able to drill, bounce a certain number of basketball compared to what the record was established.
Hmm.
She won the spelling bee. Then you had another one in Britain that won the math contest throughout the whole country.
That gives me something to study up on.
Yeah, it's a way that these parents and these families, the goals, the high bar that they set for their children. And their children, because of their respect for authority, they work at it and they stay at it, stick to it. It's easy to be dissuaded by your peers.
Right. Let me see. Boy, this is you talking about the script spelling bee, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, script spelling bee, okay.
This girl was from down in Louisiana. That's where she lived. Her family lived.
Okay.
She's gotten in. Now, not to say that you don't have some black American kids that's doing well. You do. A lot of them. But they don't care for the glory. I know people used to like to try to interview my grandson. I said, nope, they don't need no interview. Why would you get involved with that? Somebody wants to, with an ulterior motive, want to be use your child for the picture, a poster child for their movement.
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, our family is highly conservative. It just wouldn't fit right. It wouldn't fit right on the poster for the NAACP. It wouldn't fit right on the poster of the Urban Years. It wouldn't fit right on the poster of the Black Panther Party. It wouldn't fit right on the poster of something for Malcolm X or Marcus Love. That just ain't nothing wrong with those who are. But, that just ain't it. But anyway, that's some good information.
Yeah,
and
I'm reading about that. The young lady you were talking about with the spelling bee. Man, very impressive.
Yeah. And these people always talking about what blacks wasn't allowed to read and write. Well, that just ain't true. How in the heck... Let me ask you something.
Well, in order to build a lot of the infrastructure, they had to read blueprints and stuff like that.
According to the fables, they had to be able to read. But you in your home, who's going to stop you from teaching your child to read and write and do math? They didn't stop me with mine. And that was done at home. And you know that one picture, they show one photograph with Einstein lecturing to a room full of black students. You ever
seen
that?
That picture. No, I haven't seen that picture.
Well, if I run across it again, I'll share it with you. But that there in itself, a picture is worth a thousand words. We're talking about these black kids are being lectured at a lecture conversation with Einstein. And the one telltale sign is his period in history. That picture there was around 1919, 1921. Well, I thought you said blacks wasn't allowed to go to school and read and write. Huh?
Mm. Well.
So some of these alibis, now there was cases where that was occurring, but it wasn't all cases. The way it's made to seem based on how it sounds. Never get into the fine details. I asked the radio host that yesterday. I said, what details are you talking about? You making these shuck and jive assertions that just flies over the head of your listeners, and we know who they are. It's a Detroit station. I say, what details are you talking about? Get into the details. You talk about, made mention about historical black colleges, and you made mention of Donald Trump. Well, if you cared about your historical black colleges, then where is your emphasis and concern of those black kids in the elementary grades? Because if they're not making it at the elementary grades to prepare them for the rigors of college, they're going to fail. That is probably attributed to one reason that you only have five historical black colleges and universities at any given time that have a graduation rate of over 50% in 6 years, L.A.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's taken 6 years, what does that equate to economically? Ask
yeah,
you that question.
I'm going to have to do the spelling bee. I'm on her Wikipedia page. I'm listening to you, but I'm fascinated
well,
with her school. I'm glad you brought her up.
That equates to having to pay 50% more.
Mm-hmm.
Problem number one. Then you're going to have to extend loans and so on and so on. But if you don't get your child prepared for the rigors of advanced education, they're going to have a difficult time. If not, walk away from it because of the disgust. But anyway, I don't want to take up your time. It's,
well, thank
o'clock.
You for the information, and let me, I'm going to do a separate one on his, but the young lady, she's only 15 years old now, Zalia Avant-Garde, born February 9, 2007, is an American speller, basketball player, and juggler. Once again, she's just 15 right now. She won the 2021 Scripps National Spelling Bee. She is the first African-American contestant to win the bee, and is the second black winner after Jamaica's Jody Ann Maxwell. All right, she's 15 years old right now.
You see how they describe her?
Yeah.
African who?
American.
Well, see, that's where the problem comes in. She's not no African American. She's a Ghanaian American.
Yeah, you're right.
What's her name again?
Zalia Avant-Garde.
Avant-Garde?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. G-A-R is a hyphen. Avant, then dash, then G-A-R-D-E. It says, all right, the history behind that is, hold on, let me, has to do with her dad, all right. She was born in Harvey, Louisiana, the daughter of Alma Hurd and Gerara Spacetime. Her father chose her last name to honor John Coltrane. She has cited Malala Yousafzai, I butchered that name, Serena Williams, and Coco Gauff as her inspirations. All right, that's her inspirations. But her father His name is Gerara Space Time. That's his, so that's not an American name.
Yeah, so I mean, it is what it is, but they should, these people.
No, they don't. They don't put the roots on here, the bloodline.
Yeah, those people on the census don't break their names out, especially blacks that come from other countries, which they're not supposed to amalgamate. They come here to add, like she's doing. She's adding her family working. And look at the rigors that her father put her to. What were they studying? Like how many thousand words they study a day? I think it's mentioned in that story.
All right, hold on. Yeah, she's worth.
That there is.
Yeah, I'm sure she put in the work.
Absolutely. Now, the average family, when you're coming out of your inner cities and that, they're playing basketball, football, more so than they are putting in time on academics.
You're right. It's within the culture.
So to do what she did in the time that she put in, don't leave time for that other stuff because it's only 24 hours a day. And
sleep,
eat, so on and so on. You ain't got time to be out there doing the activities.
All right. Here's a little bit more information about her. Avant-Garde and her three brothers are homeschooled by their parents. She began to practice over... I'm tired of them putting all this sports stuff in there. Let's see. When she was five, she decided that she wanted to achieve to be a world's records in the Guinness Book of World Records by her eighth birthday. She did that with this spelling bee.
Well, just the fact that she's homeschooled tells a lot about the parents because normally average parents cannot homeschool because what they need to homeschool the child in, they don't themselves know.
Right. Well, many Africans, they're big on education.
Yeah. I mean,
very
the facts is what it is. So good luck to the young lady and good luck to those others. I tell you one time, I came to a restaurant, African Palace, which is my favorite restaurant. I won't have been on for a long time. And the table of Nigerians there, some of them I knew. And I sat down and started talking to him. And at the end of the table, it was this little girl. And she was coloring in a coloring book.
Mm-hmm.
But come to find out, she is the youngest student to enroll in Washington University in St. Louis, which has been acclaimed the Little Harvard of the Midwest Medical School. Did you hear that?
Yeah. I think I've read that.
Little girl, I'm looking at her. She's coloring the coloring book. I guess she also had time to be normal. But she was enrolled at Washington University Med School. And I forget how old she was. She must have been about 11, maybe 12, if that old. But that's a phenomenon. If I may say, but I'm going to let you get on back to your day, man. I don't want to hold up and waste up your
money. Well, thank you for the
information,
and Pianki, and we're going to do I'm going to do some real research on this young lady, Spelling Bee Lady, and do a feature on her. And today our feature was wait a minute. Let me catch myself here. Did I catch it in time? Yeah, I did. Didn't want to run out of time. The Barber of Natchez. like I said, this dude with no internet, no tablet, no cell phone, born a slave, learned a trade barbering from his brother-in-law, took his barbering profits with no Facebook back then, became wealthy, got his finance together where he bought an 800 acre farm. That's like 800 football fields. 16 slaves he owned himself. And the governor's day job wasn't enough. Maybe the governor got turned down at the bank. This is the governor of the state of Mississippi. And he had to go to a black man, born a slave, for a loan. Now, I'm not making this up. Okay. This is all documented. So may he be an inspiration to all, the Barber of Natchez. And the question of the day, we might not answer today, maybe we might get it tomorrow or by the end of the week. Do you have to be, well, hold on, now I'm basing this on Elon Musk. Elon Musk he was born in Africa, Pretoria, South Africa. He also has American citizenship. Therefore, Elon Musk, who is white, is an African American. So the question that I was about to ask, do you have to be black to be African American? The answer has to be no. Because you don't have to be black to be African. You know what? I got to sleep on this because I'm tripping myself up. But in the case of William Johnson, the barber from Natchez, William Johnson was born a slave. He was American. And from what I've read about him so far today, he never even visited Africa. So can you really call a black person African American if they've never been to Africa? Or their parents didn't even come from Africa. My mother came from New Orleans, Louisiana. My father came from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. They're not African. So how can I be African American? I get the American part. We were all born here. My grandparents, both sides, born in the United States. So let me marinate on that. Let me sleep on that so I can phrase the question right. Oh, let's go to the phone lines here. 410 area code, your mic is open.
Good morning, Brother Elan. I would like to congratulate the young lady that's the Spelling Bee champion. We've had a lot of black individual teenagers that have entered that contest that have placed well, but they've never won it. So hats off to her. I'm gonna answer your question with a question. I know that Elon Musk, or what his name is an African American. John Kerry's wife is an African American. what's her name? Patricia Hines Carey.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah, she was born in Africa, but she came over here and got American citizenship when she married one of the Hines brothers that's famous for Hines ketchup ever. What the heck is?
Oh, yeah, you know what? You're right. She before she married Carey, she did came she was a widow when she married him. Yeah, she did come from money. Yeah, by marriage, though, by marriage.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of others. But look, I'm going to answer your question with a question. If a person was born over here and two generations away from where they came from, like an Italian, can you say they are Italians? They've never been there, born here for three or four generations. Can they call themselves Italian Americans? What about Chinese? Mm. Chinese people that's never been to China. Their people been here for
that is true. Can you call them?
They call themselves
Chinese Americans, or can you call them Italian? That's a very good question.
And I say that
because
if you're
going
strictly
by nationality, they're American.
Exactly. Now, the thing is, you know, we black folks have to jump through hurdles when we try to come up with an identity. That's why I always call myself a black person. That transcends all nationalities, all tribes, all religions, because that's one thing you can't take on us. We're all black. Now, you can go to Africa, you can go to India, you can go to anywhere you want to go. People are going to recognize you by your skin color. And the first thing I'm going to hear somebody say, well, what about if you're mixed? Well, like if your parents are black, according to the United States, they say if you got one drop of black blood in you, you black. That goes for any white person that's mixed. So my thing is, I go with the DNA and whatever else there is. Hey, if your mother's black or your dad is black, you black. Mm. So now, I'm just putting that out there. In fact, I'm going to give you another one. These white folks that's been born over here, they don't have, is the right word, pedigree. They don't know where the hell they came from. They can't trace their ancestry back, but they claim Europe as their homeland, don't they?
Yeah.
They definitely claim Europe, and they've never been there. Don't even know where the hell they come from. You got some Irish people in Boston that's never been to Ireland. Kennedy.
Well, many.
Say again?
Hey, many of them that live in Boston has never been to Ireland. You're right.
Yeah. They don't know what they can't trace their ancestry back to Ireland, but they were told that they were Irish. Scots and every damn thing else. So, yeah, if black folks want to call themselves African Americans, they can. But I have a problem even being called America. How did this place get to be called the United States of America? Where did the America come from? Do you know?
Well, that's from what, Americo Vespucci? They named it after him?
That's what they say. But I don't think he ever came over here, did he?
Well, let me look that up real quick.
Yeah, they say he drew maps of this place, but I don't know if he ever said
Columbus never set foot on what we now call the continental United States.
No, he didn't.
He was in some place like, closest he got here was probably the Dominican Republic. But that's not the United States.
Well, the Hispaniola is the island of Haiti and
he set foot there. That's where he set foot.
He never
set foot in South America, the continent. He never set foot in the continental United States. That's Columbus.
That's right. Yeah. But we always say that he discovered America though, don't we?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't get hooked up on semantics. You know, I mean, I am who I am. In fact, I'm going to just be honest with you, Brother L.A., and I'm going to put this out there for anybody that wants to, that really wants to dispute what I'm saying. I call myself a black ancient African Egyptian because I'm going to claim that heritage. Everybody else is claiming it. I'm going to claim ancient Egyptians as part of my heritage. Because if you look at the empire of the Egyptian, it spread it all the way from the West Africa all the way over to India. So, you know, I'm going to claim it because white folks are trying to claim it, so I might as well claim it too.
Mm.
In fact, if you look at those pictures on the wall, they're black, aren't they?
Yeah. I'm, all right, hold on. I got Vespucci here. All right. Marco Vespucci. Now, he came over here. Well, he came over to what we now call the Western Hemisphere 7 years after Columbus. All right. Between 1497 and 1504, Vespucci participated in at least two voyages of the Age of Discovery. First on behalf of Spain, then on behalf of Portugal. In 1503 and 1505, two booklets were published under his name containing the colorful descriptions of these explorations. It looked, now, I think the reason why they named North America and South America or the Americas in the Western Hemisphere after him is because he was a cartographer. He drew maps.
And you know what? That's debatable. I don't know if there's any proof that the man ever came here. Now, he did finance some voyages, but, you know, the way white folks lie, I'm skeptical of everything they say and write. I'm going to just be honest with you, Brother Eloy. You know, I'm going to just be frank. But I will tell you this. Amerigo Vespucci, if you read his history, I mean, but his bio, I don't know if it's in Wikipedia or not, but you know he worked for black folk, European black royals. You know that, right?
Didn't know that.
He worked. He was the agent for the De Medici family. Alessandro De Medici was
the Medici's. They were bankers, right?
Yeah, they were. They were bankers and merchants of.
Okay.
I think Venice, somewhere like that. But anyway. They were financiers. He was an agent for them. Now, they were mixed. But the thing is, their mother was a black woman that was impregnated by the Pope at that time. Popes could get married, and they could intercourse with women and everything before they changed it. But they were powerhouses. And, in fact, I think Queen Charlotte, I think she was George the Fourth or somebody's wife like that. She was the Queen of England, the Black Queen of England. They called her a consort, but she was George the Fourth. She was married to the George, King George, that you know, the Americans fought against to get their so-called independence. In fact, legend says that she was the one that was responsible for Prince Hall getting the charter for the Freemasons over here.
Okay.
But I just said that because I have some suspicions about this America, the word America, but, you know, that's a long story. I can't really prove it. I've been trying to read up on it. But the thing is, I'll go back to your original question. Yeah, if blacks want to call themselves African Americans, why not? If white folks want to call themselves African Americans, why not? But I differentiate myself. By calling myself a black African, ancient African Egyptian for my sake. Because I'm going to claim that heritage, just like these white folks claim Greece is their heritage and never been there and came from England and France and everywhere else.
And the $5 Indians.
Yes, please. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, the $5 Indians. Mm.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren and all of them.
Yeah, they busted her, though, didn't they?
Yeah, they busted her, but, you know, she says she has papers and everything.
Was,
but look,
she was ride or die before that DNA came back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, we can get wrapped up in these types of arguments, that meaningless arguments, if we want to, but, you know, I'm very clear about what I claim. And if anybody wants to debate me on it, they can, you know, but. In fact, black folks ought to claim it also. In fact, black folks can claim anywhere on this planet, really, Brother L.A.
Well, we've been everywhere.
You think about it. Everywhere that the white boy went, he found us there. We were already there before he got there. Columbus has it in his journals. Ponce de Leon has it in his. What's his name?
Columbus, his navigators were two Africans.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, black Africans. Yeah, they navigated all that for him.
What
Matthew
was the Henson,
he got to the North Pole first.
Yeah, yeah. So, and in fact, I'm going to go with this. When DeSoto, was it that his name, when he got to Central America, he found blacks already there. In the central of so-called Central America, I think he landed somewhere then where Honduras or El Salvador or somewhere. But anyway, when he got there, there was blacks already there.
Right.
In fact, those stoneheads, those giant stoneheads, they're those Olmecs. When you look at them, you can't dispute that they're not black. You can't contest that they're not black.
Right. All right, well,
so in answer to your question,
there's still an identity crisis out there. Well, I call it an identity crisis.
For us, it is, Brother L.A. But look, I'm going to tell you this. You can make up any type of identity you want, and all you got to do is codify it. Now, you can take it for what it is. An Italian, I mean, Italian is just a nationality, right?
Right.
A Frenchman is just a nationality.
Right.
Spain is just a Spaniard is just a nationality. But what is their race? See, race trumps all of this stuff. Nations is just a written agreement on a piece of paper that says, hey, we're organizing ourselves around these principles, just like the United States here. The Constitution, everybody wrote this on paper, and they say we're going to organize ourselves around these words. So if you're a United States citizen, you can be anything, black, white, Japanese. I mean, you can be any damn thing you want to, but you're organizing yourself as a citizen of the United States. Am I right?
Yeah.
And you're identifying yourself as an American. United States of America. You're an American citizen. Now, we just, in this conversation, said that America covers North America, Central America, South America. So now, which America are we talking about? So you can make up an identity as long as you organize around it. But the one thing that blacks ought to do is organize around their race, just like white folks have organized around their race. Now, there are different parts. You got so many countries in Europe, and you got so many
and we need to have a discussion on this. Where I'm going to start it now. All right, I'm looking at, prior to the Internet and all that, when I was in high school, they said there were three classifications of race. Caucasoid, Mongoloid, and Negroid. Now, here in 2022, I'm on Wikipedia. Not Wikipedia. Let's see. Hold it. What are the three racial classifications?
Hold on.
All right, hold on. I'm going to the one that says four. Racial classification was the foundation of all apartheid. Oh, this says apartheid laws. That's South Africa. They went by native, colored, Asian, and white. Now, let me see. Let's see. How many classifications of race are there? The revised standards contain five minimum categories of race: American Indian or Alaska Native, Asian, Black, or African American, Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, and white. There are two categories for Hispanics can be Latino. Wait a minute. See, they done switched up here because like European and Caucasian are two different peoples. And let me use geography to point that out. On a DNA level. England, let's take a lighter skin. You know, we need to bring anthropologists on here because I'm not an anthropologist. Typically, when an American says a white person, they're lumping all lighter-skinned people into one group. But, like, if you take a white person from England, Denmark, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Portugal, Spain, France, those places, those are white Europeans. Whereas Caucasian, you have to look at the word. And that starts on a continent that divides Europe and Asia, which is Caucasia. So you got people like Kanye West's wife. What's her name?
I know who you're talking about.
There's a whole bunch of them. What was the name of that the lawyer that he died that was OJ's buddy? Kardashian.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Kim
Kardashian.
Except for their mother. Kim Kardashian. All those Kardashian kids who came. Their dad was I forgot their dad's name, but Kardashian. Kardashian is. He's Caucasian. Caucasian. The country that he came from,
Armenia.
Armenia is in Asia, and the people who come out of that country are Caucasian. Now they have other countries where Caucasian people come from. Mother Teresa, she was Caucasian. She was not European. However, a lot over here by custom, we lump anybody lighter skin into white folks, and white folks, like, for instance, Kardashians, who are Caucasian, and the Kennedys, which were Irish Catholics here in the United States, they're not the same people. But over here, we lump them in together and call them white folks. Because Armenia, a lot of those Caucasian countries, they had their genocides and slavery and, they got horror stories all through that. So, but it was simplified when it was, at least when I was younger, Caucasoid, Mongoloid, and Negroid. Now they got all these different definitions and metrics.
Well, it was a German sociologist that came up. Well, when I went to school, there was four definitions: Negroid, Caucasoid, what's the other one?
Mongoloid.
Mongoloid, and there was another one for the Chinese and the Japanese, Peking or some stuff. But anyway, here's the deal: if you look at the census,
somebody attempted to make Ethiopians Caucasian.
Exactly. Look, if you go to Italy down to the southern portion and down in Corsica, and you go to Greece, those people are real dark too. So, I mean.
Yeah, I've been over to Italy and I've seen some. I know what you're talking about. Well, the Dravidians who are black, no matter how you slice it, they are black. And they're trying to, and some people classify them as Caucasian.
They do. In fact, what's that guy's name? Vijay Singh, that was the golfer, won the Masters before. What's his name? The Caucasian brother.
About Tiger Woods.
Yeah, Tiger Woods. He won it before Tiger Woods did, but he didn't say he was black. But if you look at him, he was blue-black, Vijay Singh.
That's what I'm saying. See, I'm looking at these racial classifications, particularly when they revise in every few years. It's political. It's political. That's the way I see it. I want to find something based on strictly DNA, where you can't refute the science.
Well, you can't do that. You can't do it because, look, the original man was black. So now, if you want to go there, everybody got some blackness in them.
Oh, yeah, so that's now, true. And due to climate change and diet and whatnot, people turn into something else.
But there was a German sociologist that divided the races of people into categories. I can't think of his name. If I ever do, I'll text it to you. But he was the one that came up with this classification.
Right.
Was
his writings or conclusions based? Was politics involved in that?
Well, it was a justification for enslaving Africans. That's what black Africans. Mm-hmm. That's what it was all about during that time.
They got the Pope to sign off on slavery, though.
Yeah, exactly.
That was political there. Well, you give me your tithes and offering, give me 10% of your profits, and we're good.
Yeah, Vatican was the one that divided the Africa up into pieces for each European nation. What was the name of that?
Well, yeah, Africa is even a European name.
They say it is, yeah. But
well, the thing was Kemet was the name before that, but even during our lifetime, Bush, one of these presidents, when they were about to declare war on somebody, they called in Billy Graham. They did a photo op with him and whatnot, and trying to get a religious person to sign off on all this craziness. But race, I don't know. Because, like, for instance, you have, and you got videos on YouTube, you have black folk that were born in this country that are dissatisfied with this country that, now, their philosophy, not all, but quite a few, that all skin folk are kin folk. So then they go over to Africa where they totally identify differently. They're not identifying by skin tone. They're identifying by tribe. They're identifying by language. So when you get somebody from over here, then let's say they're coming from Baltimore, and they land in Gambia, where there might be 20 indigenous languages, along with a tribe to go along with each one of those, or tribes to go along with each one of those languages, And a culture, and the word culture basically means behavior. And then, you know, they get all upset because their idea of skin folk and kin folk, and they discover they're not kin folk with people that live in most of Africa. So they pack it up and come back over here. Some of them stay over here and absolutely love it, though.
Yeah, but you know what, Brother L.A., all of that tribal stuff is foolishness, and I'm going to tell you why. And it's just like here. You got Crips and Bloods. You
right.
got Keystone Rangers and Gangsters Disciples and all this foolishness. You got Masons and Elks and all of this stuff.
You know what? And all of those are different tribes. You're right.
All of those are different tribes. And the trick is this, Brother L.A., in China, I was talking to a Chinese woman. We became friends, and I was telling her, I said, you know, we got all of these different languages and dialects and everything. She said, you know what? China got just as many languages and dialects as Africa does or more.
Yeah, they do.
But
they
what
do.
Happened is they decided to boil it down to one language, which is their Mandarin. I think that's the governing language. So that, I mean,
yeah, that's probably the two main languages are Mandarin and Cantonese, but I think for
right.
business or government transactions is Mandarin.
That's right. That's right. So now, you know, we black folks, we always get it twisted. And the reason why we get it, and that's why come we in the shape we in now. In Germany, when I was stationed in Germany, if you, where I was stationed at, the guy told me, say, if you go to Bremerhaven, it's a dialect that he didn't quite understand. So he'd have to stay there for a while before he could pick up on the dialect. Now that was
right,
in Germany.
You know, when I was over there, I was in a place called Krausheim, which wasn't too far from man. Listen, I was even flying Frankfurt. Then about a 2-hour ride or 3-hour ride back, and then Munich. What was it? Munich was probably a closer location. But at Schwabisch, there was a part of like southwest German where they talked, the dialect was Schwabisch.
Right.
And you had, now I'm talking about native, you had native Germans that, you know, like, well, it's, I'm trying to say what you're just saying. You're right. All, you can be born in the country, but, you know, you might not know the dialect.
Yeah, well, you know, but the thing is, black folks will find any kind of way to disorganize themselves or either cause friction amongst themselves. Now, the other thing is, if you come where I'm at in North Carolina and you go down to South Carolina, the Gullahs down there, I have to really mm-hmm. concentrate to understand what they say because their phrasing
man,
and everything.
That's a whole other language there.
Yeah.
That's a whole other language.
Yeah, so whenever anybody say, well, you know, Africans can't get together because they got different tribes and all of this, it's foolishness because what happens is you have an organized group like Europeans and Chinese come in there and rip them off everything they got because they play against those divisions, just like they play against those divisions with us here in the United States. You know, you got this foolishness. If I live on the east side, I can't go on the west side. Or if I'm on the west side, I can't go to either side, north, east, or west. You know, that kind of foolishness. You know, but the thing is, we'll come up with any kind of foolishness to not come together for our own good, and that pisses me off.
You got a point there.
Yeah. And look, before you leave and before I forget it, the Caribbean islands are called what? Latin America, right?
Oh, yeah, some people do call them Latin America, yeah.
And you hear some Hispanics say they're Latino, right?
Right.
You know where that came from, don't you?
I do not.
The word is Ladino, Latino, L-A-D-I-N-O. If I get a chance,
okay.
I'm going to text it. the arrogance of Jews. They claim that they gave that the name, their name, because look, the Jews was all up in here, you know, they was influential in the slave trade and everything else. And look, most of the, both people that came over here from Cuba, a brother told me, a Cuban, black African, Afro-Cuban told me, said, well, look, we had a hard time coming over here because most of the Cubans that we know in Little Havana and Miami, most of those are Jewish Hispanic Jews. Mm. And the thing is, he was the one to tell me, he said, well, Latino really is a word for Latino, L-A-D-I-N-O, which means a Sephardic Jew. So they claimed all of that area as theirs. So whenever you hear Hispanic say that he's a Latino, that's where that word came from.
Hmm.
And they run it. Most of those white Hispanics that's down there, that's ruling in those countries, they are Jewish. They have Jewish ancestry.
Hmm. That reminds me of a movie I saw once with, it's called Q&A. Armando Asante's in it, along with Charles Dutton, he's in it too, and Nick Nolte. There's a scene in there where the guy needed some bodyguards, and he hired two black dudes, but they from Cuba, and they were Cuban Jews.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
Bardix was the ones in Northern Africa. And part of Spain, because, you know, you and I go round and round about this, about the Moors.
Mm-hmm.
In actuality, they don't give blacks credit for this. But the thing is, it was black Africans from the Sahara part of West Africa that went up there and civilized those bastards. And the thing is, they tried to say there were Arabs, but now I'm going to send you this guy. Because Walter Williams, Dr. Walter Williams, Pianki's familiar with him because Pianki got him to speak over there in St. Louis, I believe, but Pianki's not going to agree with him. But what happened is he came out and said, look, Islam did not originate in Saudi Arabia. And he has documentation to prove it if I ever get a chance. I'm going to send you his book, The Historical Origins of Islam.
Now, where do you say did it originated from?
It originated from there in Spain. The guy, the Muhammad that they say founded the religion was a Moor, as we know him, that started that philosophy. He said there was two different types of Islam. There was one, the guy that started the whole thing came out of Spain. But they'll tell you that it came out of Saudi Arabia because
right.
The Ottoman Turk was some kind of way he had some disciples to go into the Asia Minor, which is Turkey and all those places, and convert those people. And when they got power under the Ottoman Empire, that's when they came over and started telling people, converting people, and the Egyptians especially, at that time into their philosophy. But he says there was two Islam, the Islam that we worship, that they worship today. The Quranic Islam was created in France by a bunch of Jews. But I'm going to send you his, mm-hmm. I'm going to send you his take on it and let you see what you think about it. But
okay.
But if you look at the timeline, it was nowhere in the world that Islam originated out of Saudi Arabia. It didn't do it. And the thing is, when you look at the Moors that came out of Africa, West Africa already had universities and everything else before Europe did. In fact, they went over there and civilized those Europeans because they were, that's who brought the Renaissance in, the European Renaissance. If you read it and you can think outside the box, I'm gonna send you his take, and I'm gonna send you the book.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Well, hold it now. Didn't Egypt claim to have universities back like even before Cleopatra's time?
Of course, yeah. They call it Egyptian mystery system.
But that doesn't
system.
Mean they originated there, though.
Yeah, it originated in Egypt. The mystery system. Yeah. Yeah, those temples, they were universities. Luxor, Karnak, all of those places. You can ask Pianki that, you know, if he hasn't been totally brainwashed. You know, and I
there's a lot of history over that way.
You know, but yeah, Luxor, Karnak, all of those places, those temples were universities. Have you read George G.M. James's book, Stolen Legacy?
Seen it. Haven't picked it up yet. Sorry,
well,
years ago, haven't picked it up yet.
Yeah, yeah, he breaks all of that down. Because his claim is, just like Dr. Walter Williams, is that there were no such thing as Greek philosophy and all of that. He said it was stolen out of Egypt, in which it was, because if you read I took geography. I mean, I took European history and I took American history. And if you read European history, Europe really didn't become touch with civilization until Alexander the Great went down into Egypt. And I'm going to give you this one. You know, when you say Kemet is the land of the blacks, well, if you break down Ethiopia, when the Greeks got there, they call all of those Egyptians Ethop, which means black, burnt face, or black face burnt by the sun. And if you put the IA on it, that means land of the black face, or burnt face, doesn't it? If you put the IA on Ethop, Ethiopia.
Now I'm looking at Stolen Legacy now.
Well, in fact, you can read it online, really.
Yeah, I'm going to look for it, and then you probably got some video on it. And then I got to buy, how long did that book, The Miseducation of the Negro. That's a classic.
Yeah,
how long did
I read.
Didn't get it back, so I'll read it again.
Yeah. And look, I'm going to give you a couple of other books. What is it, Sex and Race, Volume 1 by J.A. Rogers. He explains all of this stuff. What was the other one? World Great Men of Color by J.A. Rogers. I used to sell all of those books, but I started reading them before I went in the book business. But Brother L.A., like Brother Pianki said a few minutes ago, and this I will agree with him on, two things I'll agree with him on. We're cursed because we have allowed another people to take possession of our minds. So that's a curse. And the other thing is, what you and I are talking about are never getting in schools, especially with this foolishness called critical race theory. And that's why come all of this stuff is a dust-up, because they know once people start discussing what you and I are discussing, you'll find out that white folks have never had a culture. They don't have one now. In fact, everything that goes on in America here was created by black folk. The food, the education, you name it. And I sent you this thing a years back about how black folks came over here and set up the first public school system on this soil here. And it's documented by W.B. Du Bois and a white guy. The first public school system was originated by blacks coming out of slavery. So, you know, we don't have anything to be ashamed about, but we won't notice until we develop our own education system. But anyway, I'm gonna get out of here and let you go. We're over time. So.
Okay, yeah, I'm reading up on this stuff. I mean, on the phone while you're giving it to me, taking notes. All right, then, Beasley. Thanks for the feedback. I've been looking forward to that information. And have a good rest of the day.